Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yeah, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with the great Pete Seeger, of course, and David Burns with the Rivertown Kids. That song is on the album Tomorrow's Children from Appleseed Records, and it won a Grammy, which we like to hear. And of course, hard to believe, hard to imagine, as my good friend Dennis Bernstein was telling me yesterday, a world without Pete Seeger. Dennis, are you on with us?
I am here. On with you, Harvey. Thank you.
You sound loud and clear. We're going to have a good show. We're going to break it to half for a couple minutes to hear Dana Lyons sing the other version of the Solartopia song. But in the meantime, we've got a flat-out, straight, beautiful hour to talk together, Dennis. Thank you so much for having me on your show, Flashpoints, at KPFA Radio last night. At 5 p.m. in Berkeley time, and we are both in Berkeley, California today, although several miles apart. Dennis, you are one of the great radio talk show hosts of our generation. You've been with KPFA. I'll let you tell your radio history, but you are a stalwart on the progressive side of the dial, have been for decades. Tell us a bit before we get into this, for some of my listeners who may not know you. Give us your history, if you would.
Well, I started in New York City as a poetry editor at the Pacifica radio station there, WBAI. Then I started a program called The Open Ear, where I would invite people who were never published to send in a couple of minutes, and we'd put it on every week. And from there, I got deeply engaged in radio. Before I switched over to journalism, I'm sure I was the first one ever to produce for public radio, the complete live reading of James Joyce's Ulysses.
I mean, oh my God, you read the whole thing?
On air, 35 hours. We, typical Pacifica, we only broke twice for the news. I did it at the time it was called, you would appreciate this, Bloomsday Books, because it all happens, all 700 and whatever pages happen in a 24-hour period. You know, just swallowing a piece of food could last 30 pages. but we did it. It was beautiful. We did it at a bookshop on the Upper West Side. We had readers all through the night. At one point, this guy comes charging in with a huge bag of bagels. He was a taxi cab driver. He'd been listening all night, and he was delighted to come join us. We had about 30 chairs there, and people could read along. So that was my first big Pacifica radio extravaganza. Of course, I did what was called the Great Peace March. I co-hosted with Studs Terkel and Robert Knight in New York, where we documented folks coming walking across the country, across the bridge for peace. And then I began a key investigation into the Iran-Contra scandal. I just was in, I guess, the wrong place at the right time, covering the Tucson Sanctuary trial in just at the border there during the U.S. wars against El Salvador and Guatemala and the people of Central America, where the southern border became the direct barometer of the intensity of the vicious death squad wars that the U.S. was supporting down south. So from that coverage, it was a nine-month sanctuary trial in 1985 and 86. From covering that trial, I learned that there was this guy in the basement of the White House called Oliver North, and he was engaged in a very dark black box operation using drug money and working with terrorists to overthrow the Sandinista government. That was the beginning among the beginnings of the Contra drug investigation.
So you are the guy who blew Oliver North's cover. Is that right?
A number of us were jumping all over this at the time, so I'm not taking credit for that. I'm just saying, let's just say I was on the crowd scene of history, and we were all taking notes.
But the
key aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal, particularly having to do with the drugs, were broken by myself, Vince Bielski, and Robert Knight. I wrote a major cover story for Spin magazine that documented through our obtaining information and a connection with a Senate investigator that showed that Oliver North and the U.S. government were deeply engaged with traffickers, people who were associated with the Medellin cartel, that Oliver North was making all kinds of marriages of convenience. Say, you know, you bring our illegal weapons down for the Contras and we'll sort of help you get your drugs into the United States. As a part of this policy, we discovered that there was a presidential finding. Imagine this. In one part of the White House, you got Nancy Reagan saying, just say no to drugs. Other part, in 1983, you've got William French Smith, the first attorney general, highest law enforcement official in the land, I guess if you exclude the president. And he's signing a secret finding that allows U.S. agents, CIA, FBI, whatever, to work with drug traffickers to witness drug operations. You remember the cocaine epidemic through the 80s?
Oh, yeah.
To witness these drug operations and not report them because the higher good was the national security, or in that case, overthrowing the Nicaraguan government.
Amazing, amazing. Well, Dennis, you are now, of course, I love how our country, as you say, has a split personality on this situation. It's really great for a national hero, so-called, like Oliver North, to bring in literally tons of cocaine into the United States. But if you get caught with a joint, you go to prison. It's truly a staggering reality. So, Dennis, you have a show now called Flashpoints at KPFA in Berkeley. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, the show actually grew out of the New York show, and it was founded on the at the beginning of the first Gulf War, the first Bush War in the Gulf. I moved to California in 1989. In fact, I was looking for a place to live during the earthquake, and that was an interesting, auspicious beginning.
A good thing you weren't sleeping under the Bay Bridge. We wouldn't be talking to you now.
No, really, and I ended up, you know, it was a vacation that turned into a reporting operation, of course. But I, you know, I was here in 1990. I was given a show on KPFA. I sort of invented a show called Flashpoints, and it was focused at that time on the Gulf War, and then, of course, we expanded it out to cover all issues, you know, a lot of human rights, national security stuff, and we do torture regularly.
Well, you didn't torture me yesterday, but thankfully. Your show basically is a stalwart of the left, and you continue to do coverage of events. Tell us, you told me a story about how just in the last few days, a policeman relieved you of your cell phone.
And I wasn't the only one. You know, I'm identifying myself as press, and that got me a smash, a whack, and a cell phone in pieces.
Well, where was this? Where were you?
This was in Berkeley, there were nonstop, endless actions that were taking place. This isn't a big deal. The big deal is that there are unbelievably large numbers of young people in the streets with focused conviction, and they are not intimidated And I think that it's an inspiration to be out there, you know, to see them be at Sproul Hall. And I recently did a special on Saturday when there were protests. I guess it was a week ago Saturday when there were protests happening all over the country, and I did a 5 o'clock special on Saturdays, a Flashpoint special. And, you know, it was unbelievable what was out there. But what I heard,
what was unbelievable? Tell us what was unbelievable. Well, was it powerful?
Yeah, I mean, like, for instance, I really loved the fact that Al Sharpton had the rally in Washington, D.C., and the stage was stormed by a bunch of young women who demanded to speak and did. And you remember that? Do you remember that famous speech at Sproul Plaza? The wrench,
yeah,
and all that, and the gears. And tell
us about. Many of our listeners may not. So tell us about the speech at Sproul Hall. I just watched a fantastic movie.
I don't know why I'm blanking on. I don't know why I'm blanking on his name.
Doesn't matter.
Come on, tell me. You got to tell me.
Mario Savio.
Mario Savio. Mario Savio Plaza, which is where many of these protests in terms of the university have begun and then gone into the streets. But for that broadcast a week ago Saturday, these young women storming the stage was such a beautiful, powerful moment. Their voices were so real. You know, we do radio. It's an emotional medium. Their voices were so real, so inspired by the moment, so obviously devoted and full of commitment. I heard it, and as soon as I heard it, I heard Mario Savio's speech. So I ended the program by playing Mario Savio and then this woman. And I tell you, the emotional, like if there's an emotional vibe measurer, I think that's maybe a lie detector or something, it would have shown that the emotion was perfectly tuned, and that, as was the case with Mario Savio back then, this was the moment. This is a moment in history, and it was huge. And this young woman's voice was just an inspiration. You talk about missing Pete Seeger. I was telling you that I was really worried about living in a world without Pete Seeger. But when I heard this young woman's voice and when I heard her commitment, I felt okay.
Well, listen, these are demonstrations in wake of the police killings of Eric Garner and Michael Brown. And what you're telling us, and I'm sure many people are not aware, is that there are constant demonstrations going on of young people in Berkeley, California, day by day, and that there are confrontations with the police, one of whom apparently took your cell phone and stomped on it, even after you told him with your media, or especially probably after you told him you were with the media. So what is the nature of these demonstrations that are ongoing now in Berkeley and elsewhere around the country?
Well, I think that people are not only fed up, they're motivated that with the advent of the 21st century technological boom and the access to information and the quick sharing of information with young people who grow up with these machines growing out of their bodies, there is a unique thing happening, and it happens very fast. The protests, the amount of protests in different places and how people knew about them and where to go and what happened, and the militancy, the taking of free. I mean, I've been witness to a couple of freeway takings. But these folks took the freeway, they focused, and when they wanted to leave, they left.
How many people are we talking about?
Thousands. That's why the police couldn't hold them back. Thousands. One protest that I marched in to the middle of, out of my door at KBFA, make a left, go to university, 5,000 people marching down to take over the freeway. Now, they all didn't get on the freeway, but there were that many people in the street. The corporate press don't want to say it, but they had to say things like 2,000 and 3,000. There were 5,000 freaking students who were just focused, like, you know, sort of like, you know how you see birds focused, you know, yeah, and they turn so one direction, and then they turn another direction, and it's like all sort of pre-planned. Discipline, militancy, and people who were really fed up. I mean, it was quite inspiring to feel the vibe.
Well, we talked about this a little bit yesterday. You know, the Michael Brown, Eric Garner killings, you know, the whole major media, all the corporate media, has been focused on the issue of race. And, of course, race is a big part of what we're trying to deal with in the wake of these killings. But the reality is that what this is really about in the bigger picture is do police in this country now have a blank check to kill anybody they want to kill and not be prosecuted? That's what's terrifying. You know, all these white people who think that just because these guys that were killed were black, it can't happen to them. That's an illusion. And I am very glad to hear that all these young people in the streets, because this is a civil liberties issue as well as a civil rights issue.
Yes, it is. And some of these kids are walking around with the Constitution in their pocket. But the point is that this is these recent killings ignited what was a growing groundswell of concern by people at all levels of the country and the culture that the criminal justice system is a criminal injustice system. In other words, there is a pattern and practice of discrimination, not a few bad apples. And it requires a revolution in how we deal with our people and our young people.
Yeah, it's quite mind-boggling. We're talking with Dennis Bernstein, host of the wonderful show Flashpoints on KPFA in Berkeley. And Dennis is a long, long time activist, stalwart of the left, and with tremendous knowledge and depth, and also a poet. And we will. Do you have your book in front of you, Dennis? Let's do a quick poem. I'm going to scatter these through the show.
I just happen to have it here.
Just happen to have page 58. If you'll read this real quick, these are like haikus. When Tina's full moon howls, I love this one. Give us a shot of that, and we're going to go to Gary Webb and the cocaine traffic. Let's take a break with Tina and the full moon.
There's a segue. When Tina's full moon howls, Tina loves to paint the night. Her skies are always militant, with bobcats bounding and black snakes rearing back, fangs up against the rest of the world. When Tina's full moon howls, the wolves of the world join in.
You know, I can attest to that. I used to go out with Tina. She was quite a one.
Yeah.
All right.
Look at that.
We started the show talking about Oliver North and your blowing his cover, and the whole Iran-Contra cocaine catastrophe that Ronald Reagan wreaked upon the world here. What's happening now is very interesting. There is a resurrection of the work of a great reporter named Gary Webb, who was absolutely trashed and completely decimated and crucified back in the day for breaking many of these stories at the San Jose Mercury and elsewhere. He ended up committing suicide. Tell us, if you would, about what Gary Webb reported and what is coming back to confirm his work.
Well, what Gary Webb did was pick up a story that was initially broken by Robert Perry, and it was written for the Associated Press. Robert Perry writes for and created the website called theconsortiumnews.com. He's a George Polk Award-winning investigative reporter who used to work for AP and then Newsweek until he told the truth too much, I guess. But Bob Perry began to report on this, and several of us joined in and picked up various aspects of it. The story there was that Oliver North and the illegal network to overthrow the Contras were deeply engaged with drug traffickers. They were using planes that were used to carry drugs, to also carry weapons to the Contras, that they had cut these kind of deals, that the State Department, Oliver North had had the State Department hire a number of these folks. They literally had State Department contracts. These were cartel members who, I guess, also needed other employment. But the idea was it was a marriage of convenience. The cartels do the illegal business of North, and then folks in the U.S. government turn a blind eye or, in fact, provide intelligence for these drug smugglers to get their wares back into the United States. So that was the we had it coming in as a marriage of convenience. I left the story off in a piece that I wrote for Newsday with Robert Knight, where we were slipped a document from Charlie Rangel at the time, 1987.
Charlie Rangel being the Democratic congressman from Harlem, who had a lot of power and a lot of insider contact.
Right, and also who was at the time the chair of the Narcotics and Terrorism Committee for the Congress. So he slipped us a document that showed that the CIA had interceded in a situation where the DEA arrested a couple of frogmen coming up on the San Francisco docks with a whole bunch of cocaine and a whole bunch of money. And
Wait. Are you on a drug here? You're saying that two frogmen. I assume these guys were in Ninja Turtle suits, right?
They got busted with I don't know how much cocaine, a lot, and tens of thousands of dollars.
And they just came up out of the bay.
They came up out of the bay, right? And it was reported the DEA kept the cocaine, but gave back the money, and the frogmen walked.
Oh, my God.
So this was sort of where East Coast met West. The Gary Webb, his part of the story was so explosive because he tracked the cocaine into South Central L.A. And the Contra connected cocaine pipeline, in which people who were working with the CIA were also supplying cocaine to the inner city in Los Angeles.
Now I have to repeat here. What you're saying is that the United States government, the Central Intelligence Agency, I assume the FBI, certainly the National Security Agency, were willfully bringing large quantities of cocaine into the United States.
Let me be clear that several key movers and shakers in the Contra operation at that time were also drug traffickers.
Well, they were
that finding that I told you about allowed the CIA to say nothing when these Nicaraguan revolutionary / drug traffickers trafficked into South Central L.A. because a cut of the money supported the Contra operation. So, for instance, you can't say the CIA officer was dealing drugs, but it is, you go to jail 15, 20 years as a federal agent just knowing that a drug deal went down and not reporting it.
And so this was sanctioned by the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration was aware that this was happening, that huge amounts of drugs were being brought into L.A., and this is not like puffs of pot here. This is cocaine, which was turned into crack, and the United States government turned a blind eye so that the cash could go down and support the right wing Contra revolutionaries who wanted to overthrow the leftist Nicaraguan government. Is that what happened?
Yes, that's what happened, and just to be clear again, when you talk about the Reagan administration, I again come back to Attorney General William French Smith. By the way, the reason we know there was this secret finding that allowed U.S. federal agents to not report trafficking, we know it because the CIA Inspector General ultimately, after it was way too late and Gary Webb had been ravaged by the liars at the Washington Post and the New York Times, the CIA Inspector General released an extensive report that documented in extreme detail much of what Gary Webb reported. That's how we know about the secret finding that Ronald Reagan's first attorney general, William French Smith, signed as Nancy Reagan was kicking her Just Say No to Drugs campaign off.
And what happened to Gary Webb, the guy who dutifully and brilliantly reported all this?
Gary Webb, I remember being at I think it was KQED with public radio in the San Francisco Bay Area, and there was a forum in which the editors of the Mercury News and Gary Webb and several of us who had been on this story in some way were invited. I remember the blowfish editor, who turned out to be a coward turncoat, praising the work of Gary Webb and the power of the story and how well it was done and all this kind of stuff, praising Gary Webb, with the other editors, direct editor, the ones who ultimately sent him off to work in a garage outside of Sacramento, essentially, and then, degraded him. I think he was ultimately quit or fired, could never get a real job, worked as an investigator for the government, became an investigator, state at Sacramento or something, was totally depressed, despondent, and took his own life.
So that's – and now, of course, he's being revived. I mean, there seems to be a resurrection of Gary Webb and his work.
Well, there's a film out now called Killing the Messenger, or is it Kill the Messenger, Killing the Messenger, which is a rather truthful rendering of key parts of Gary Webb's struggle. I and Robert Perry met a number of times with Gary Webb, tried to support him to warn him about the ramifications for doing a story like that. Anybody who touched this story lost their career. Bob Perry was a shining example, working his way up, senior reporter, editor at Newsweek, and then his bosses, his senior editors, came back and said, we're losing our access at the White House, we're having trouble, we're not getting invited to parties we want to get invited to, you're fired. Not exactly that simple, but essentially that.
Oh, I'm sure it was awful close to that. Dennis Bernstein, host of the wonderful Flashpoint show at KPFA, poet of your book is Special Ed. We're going to take a short break with the Solartopia version, the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. We'll be back in a couple of minutes to continue this scintillating conversation. We're going to talk about the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, a bit more about people in the streets, and also the future of community radio. And we'll slip in a word or two for the dear departed Joe Cocker. Let's hear it, Dana.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia.
We are back. We're back with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show for the second half hour, again with the great Dennis Bernstein, host of the Flashpoint Show at KPFA in Berkeley, and the author of a wonderful book of poetry. Dennis, can you turn to page 32 here of your book, Special Ed, before we jump back into talking about cocaine trafficking and the children, the kids in the streets, and nuclear power. Tell us about felony bouncing here.
Yeah, the felony bouncing was actually based on part of experience with one of my kids, but it was also me. I'm somebody who was failing. I write about that this in the beginning of the book. I was profoundly learning dyslexic and failed everything in school for almost through high school. But then it turns out that the school had a very good gymnastic team, and I had a knack for gymnastics, seriously, very good at it, became a state champion and all that stuff in New York. But I, it was, that trampoline got me through being, feeling stupid, feeling, you know, we didn't have a lot of money in my family. So the gymnastics and the trampoline in particular got me through, and I, you know, my kids used to think of different ways to escape their own incredible poverty, so I just sort of conflated my experiences with one of my students. This is called Felony Bound. Oh, by the way, I did, the point of the story about school is, you know, I would cut, there were times when I'd cut 20 and 30 days at a time, but I'd break into the school on the weekends when nobody was around and use the gymnastic equipment. I actually was arrested for breaking into my own high school. Anyway, this is, it's a short poem. It's called Felony Bouncing. Bobo was busted for breaking and entering. He broke into school through a back door in the boys' gym. They caught him bouncing barefooted on the trampoline. Just Bobo, eyes closed, reaching for new heights.
All right. Yeah, it's terrific.
Do you know those, I don't know if they had, when you were growing up, there were these places where they would, there were trampoline centers. They'd have like maybe 10 trampolines in the ground, and you'd rent one for a half hour, an hour. Did you ever see one of any of those?
Yeah, I have actually. They're pretty cool.
I used to, sometimes I would sneak out of my house in the middle of the night and hit, you know, either walk or hitch to this trampoline center. I'd climb over the fence. And so you'd see me bouncing there at midnight.
Wow. Did you ever get arrested for
doing
that?
Yes, I did. I got taken home once by a cop who was very amused by the whole thing.
Amazing. Amazing. Let's do another one of your poems here. On page 46, this is apropos to the season. It's called Slamming the Door on Christmas. Also talks about a gym.
Page
46 in your book.
That's real. You know, in the poorest communities, things can get very ugly around the holidays, very tense, great struggles going on at home. And a lot of times the kids in the day or two before the break, you know, as kids in the middle-class workplace, you sort of looked forward to the break. It wasn't always a pleasure in these poorest of poor neighborhoods. I mean, kids got some food at the school. Sometimes they weren't eating regularly. So it was a crazy time. And I guess I should tell you that because of so-called security, all the teachers in the school were ordered to keep their doors locked. So the doors were locked in all the classrooms. You couldn't just open them up. A teacher or somebody had to let you in. This is called Slamming the Door on Christmas. There's about 50 minutes left until Christmas recess. We are heading for the gym. That's when Kiki calls out to Luce in Miss Klein's class just as we're passing by in the hallway. Miss Klein slams shut the door while two of Kiki's fingers are still in the door jamb. Her flesh is crushed easily between sharpened edges of oak and steel. The door is locked. I am banging on the window, vying for the teacher's attention. Kiki is jumping up and down, crying for me or God or her mother or someone to help her. I smash my fist through the door window and unlock it with a handful of glass. I am standing there with my arms around Kiki, surrounded by screaming kids, both of us bleeding into the shards.
Whoa, that's a pretty powerful poem for the holiday season. Thank you, Dennis Bernstein, for reading that from your book, Special Ed. I'll ask you to do a couple more of your poems as we proceed. So in the first half hour, we were talking about the cocaine traffic that was hidden by the United States government, which distributed some of the proceeds to from turning a blind eye on huge quantities of cocaine being brought into the United States, turning a blind eye and using the money to fund right-wing counter-revolutionaries, militarists, thugs, thieves, who were working to overthrow the government in Nicaragua. Gary Webb, who broke many of these stories, was driven to suicide. You knew him, you worked with him, and now he's been somewhat vindicated, let's put it that way, in a movie. And what's the movie called?
Killing the Messenger.
Where is it? Is it out and around in theaters?
I'm not sure if it's still in theaters. It was in theaters for a while. I'm not sure whether it's still out there or whether it's made its way into the world of DVD. I don't know. But it came out, I guess, about two months ago, I like to say. And it was, you know, pretty realistic, and it finally told the story. You know, I was invited to Hollywood several times where they were considering doing a movie about the story that I actually wrote for Spin Magazine, which showed how this this kid who was trying to kick his drug problem, and he thought he would become a patriot, and so he joined the Contras in Miami to fight, to join the freedom fighters, as President Reagan said, and he found himself in the middle of a cocaine operation.
Now, wasn't there a couple of movies about the drug trade that came out of Hollywood?
Well, I mean,
sensational movies.
That's the problem, that they're sensational, and so people think they're fiction, and a lot of it is fiction. But the reality is more powerful than the fiction, and the proof is astounding. I can't tell you how many different ways and interviews I did in dark hallways and meeting people halfway between here and hell to hear some of the most extraordinary stories. One of the stories that I broke for the San Francisco Examiner when it was really a newspaper here in the Bay Area had to do with a Florida prison guard named Jesus Garcia, who was an extreme patriot, anti-Castro Cuban, who joined the North Network because he wanted to turn the clock back on communism. This guy was such a patriot, he named his first child America. So this prison guard was told...
Just like Abby Hoffman.
There you go. This prison guard was told that his secret mission was going to be an agent provocateur action, that they wanted him to join a crew who would blow up the U.S. embassy in Costa Rica, kill the ambassador or wound him, and the U.S. could use it as an excuse to directly invade Nicaragua. He refused to do it. He said, I would have killed the Russian ambassador in Managua, but I wasn't going to kill a U.S. ambassador. So the North Network got nervous, set him up on a weapons charge. He ends up in jail. And I'll never forget him, his fears around, and so much information he told us was true. And his fears, at one point there was a bomb placed on his family's doorstep, and it just didn't go off. The bomb squad was called, it just didn't go off. This was all a part of North's illegal network operation. It was an amazing story. When they arrested this Jesus Garcia, they found a suitcase in his apartment. And the suitcase said special contact, or so, you know, I don't have it on the, it's so many years ago. Contact this number. The number was the number of the national security advisor to the vice president at the time. That would be Bush the first. So his national security advisor was a connect for an illegal Contra operation, or so it did seem. His name, by the way, was Donald Gregg. Remember, one of the key reasons why Bush 1 didn't get reelected is because the Lawrence Walsh, the special prosecutor, made him an unindicted co-conspirator in his investigation of the Iran-Contra scandal. And that was a mind-blower for Bush 1,
because, I mean, he could have been indicted because he was the connect there on the ground. And at the time, his son was a mover and shaker in the Republican Party, and he was part of these illegal operations to train Contras to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. This was all part of this drug-sponsored operation that this guy by the name of Steve Carr, I wrote, this is the piece I wrote for the Spin magazine, in which we nailed the CIA as doing business with drug traffickers based on congressional information.
Talking with Dennis Bernstein, KPFA host of the Flashpoint show, about the history of Iran-Contra and the bringing in of the of drugs, turned a deaf, a blind eye by the CIA. They allowed it to happen so that money could go to fund the operation to try and overthrow the Nicaraguan government. Dennis, you're on one of the most important of all the public radio stations, and of course, public radio is always in flux. We're happy to have you on the Progressive Radio Network. Of course, radio itself is changing greatly. I'm very happy to work with this network and with the crew in New York, and you've been at KPFA for a long time. Tell us what you think about the future of community radio. What's happening with radio, and what can we expect to see?
Well, I think that it's a struggle ahead. I think that the idea of listener sponsorship is a tough row. It's hard to keep the corporations out of the business of radio. Most public radio isn't public radio anymore here, and KQED is the public radio station. But some of their programs literally take funding or are directly funded by Chevron. It's hard for me to imagine that a public radio could call itself public and take funds from Chevron and other extraordinary places. So it is a real struggle. Money has always been difficult. I remind you, this network was founded in 1949 by the poet Lou Hill, who ultimately killed himself after one of these vicious internal battles where the board voted him out of the network that he invented. So there's always been a great deal of turbulence when you're dealing with people who have their own ideas. It's amazing. I'm happy to hear about the Progressive Radio Network. Who knows? Flashpoints, you can never tell. We may need a home real soon. It's just day by day you struggle. It's hard, Harvey, I don't know how you feel. We've never talked about this, but my background, my grandfather was a very famous rabbi who wrote prayer and blessed matzah. He was internationally renowned. He had a synagogue on the Lower East Side. My uncle, Leo, Orthodox Jew, argued, but a profound and progressive liberal, argued the key cases of separation of church and state in the 50s, 60s, 70s, into the early 80s. He was the one up there. You'd always see him fighting with Buckley about church-state issues. I'm saying that to say this. One of the most difficult issues that I've covered, and one of the issues that really made my show incredibly controversial, was my willingness to give a fair voice to the Palestinian people. Immediately becoming, being considered even by my own cousins as a self-hating Jew, hypocrite, turncoat, whatever you want to call it. But there's stories like that. That just, make you a pariah. And I have no regrets about covering the hardest stories. I've talked to at least three people who were on death row and then were ultimately killed by the state. These are not pleasant conversations. They're not fundraising operations. We're credited by some of our investigations leading to keeping some prisoners alive. I'm looking at a painting here by Kevin Cooper, who was
brought back from death within a few minutes of it, who sent us this beautiful painting. I've got a lovely message from Mumia Abu-Jamal and a drawing. Thank you.
And this is based on your reporting of people on death row that no one else would touch in,
exactly,
in any of the media.
Exactly.
So, but community radio, of course, the nature of radio is transforming. It's becoming more and more internet-based. And my fear is, of course, if net neutrality is done away with, then we're going to have a ghettoized radio structure on an apartheid internet system. I mean, this is a really frightening prospect.
Well, that's where the front line is. I mean, that is where the front... I mean, we were talking about the kids in the streets. The internet became a key part of that movement. They can't, you know, if they lose that kind of quick access, if there's a traffic jam on the internet based on corporate greed and you get what you pay for sort of thing, time is money and all that, then it's going to be a huge setback for free speech. That's
and
for sure.
You would certainly think that it's something the corporations would welcome.
Well, what? Not all. I mean, it's interesting how corporations are coming down on both sides of this.
Well, tell us about that. What do you think?
Well, I don't know a lot. You see, I'm not the expert here, but I do urge. There's a number of people who you really should talk to about this, and I don't really want to go off on details that I don't know a lot about.
Okay, well, let's switch gears real quickly because we're down to our last 10 minutes. I talked on your show yesterday about shutting the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors in California. We're both, Dennis and I, speaking to our audience from Berkeley. You spent a lot of time in the Hanford Reservation. Can you quickly give us a talk about the core of what the situation is at the Hanford, Washington nuclear reservation and how you came to know so much about it?
Well, of course, it's where the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb, or the Nagasaki bomb, I believe, was built. A little fuzzy on that. The Hanford Reservation is huge, and it's built right on the Columbia River, which is the river that gives life and source to endless indigenous communities. The river is a living, growing being, a part of community life, food, health, everything, the river. So in that regard, I did a lot of investigation, not only in terms of the indigenous communities, but the downwinders, the people who live downwind from this Hanford reservation, they call it. And it's huge, and it's a mess. It's still full of incredibly dangerous material that are endangering the people around there, the water supply, the whatever. So I did a series of investigations. This is quite a while ago, and I'm sure it's just as bad now. But I interviewed a number of the downwinders. I took a trip around on the Columbia River, right around the plant. A biologist by the name of Norm Buskey had a little motor tube boat. And so we took a ride around the plant and down the river. I mean, for instance, we came upon a couple of off-duty guards from the plant who were fishing at the mouth of the plant, if you can imagine. And they were saying the fishing was good. Are you concerned about the plant? Nah, this is, you know, they said safe. This is safe stuff. Meanwhile, Norm Buskey, the scientist, had just made headlines when he gathered some fruit that was growing across from the river from the plant, a public trail where people could pick the fruit and eat it, and he jarred it into a jelly, and it was radioactive. The plants, the berries, were radioactive. He sent it to the governor. He didn't appreciate it. But he gathered them in a public spot. So I really did an extensive investigation. I was writing at the time for the Pacific News Service, now the New American Media, and the National Catholic Reporter. And I interviewed these folks who lived downwind from the plant, and I'll never forget, I mean, so many of them were so profound, but Betty Perks. Betty Perks. She started out as a kindergarten teacher and ended up as a hospice nurse to take care of her two dying children. Oh. She lived in what was called the Deaf Mile, downwind from Hanford. I interviewed a number of these people who lived on the Deaf Mile. But she told me this story. She was a Mormon. And she's saying to me, you know, I've been taught and I studied and I learned that, you know, there by this guy, his name is Jesus, and he taught us that we have to forgive. But I can't forgive them. They knew they were poisoning my children. And she says, I always wondered, you know, the pilots used to fly over that. These were guys measuring the air and stuff. And she remembered that her kid would always wave to the pilots, but they would never wave back. And she wondered why. And she was believing that it was, in fact,
because they knew that there was radiation.
That they were killing the children, that they were killing the people. And these people were given their land. It was a deal. Veterans back from the war, half-price land, come get it. And it was devastating. So Betty Perks, I remember as she told me her daughter was dying in the hospital, and she was taking care of her daughter's parakeets. And they were, you can just, during the interview, you just hear them. It's heart-wrenching, them sort of singing in the background, and her telling the story of all these people on the Deaf Mile who were sick and dying. It was unbelievable.
Last night I watched a film called Fierce Green Fire, which talked about the disaster at Love Canal. And Dennis, you and I have talked many, many times about the nuclear power plants in California and elsewhere. And of course, people downwind are dying from them as well. And we hope we can conspire along with the good folks at PRN to get some of this stuff shut down finally. Can you turn in your poetry book, Dennis? You have your poetry book. We're almost near the very end. I want you to get in one more poem here. Special ad on page 56, Flying Machines. Can you read us Flying Machines real quick for us?
Sure. Flying Machines.
Is there a story behind this one?
Well, this was my most difficult student. He was so troubled. It was hard to teach him the alphabet, but he was so incredibly musically inclined. I remember at one point, this is another poem in the book, but we used to have the show and tell in the morning, and he loved music, and he brought in this. He found this stethoscope behind the hospital, old stethoscope. It was still working. He put it to his ears. He put the listening part to his chest and started snapping the beat, snapping his fingers to the beat of his own heart, and then he's sort of laughing hysterically and saying, hey, Teach, this is where the music begins, huh?
Yeah, well, let's hear it.
But anyway, this is called Flying Machine. Richard is as hyper as a hummingbird, except when he gets to swinging. Then he can linger for hours, steady as a heartbeat. Sometimes he sneaks out in the middle of the night and swings himself to the stars. For hours he aims his toes skyward, the slender arrow of his body soaring and dipping, transformed into a dozen different flying machines, then one glorious eagle.
Beautiful, beautiful. And thank you, Dennis. And speaking of eagles, we did just lose Joe Cocker. Died this week at the age of 70. Made some great music for all of us over the years. Want to shout out to him and some of the amazing moments he gave us. Dennis, we've covered a lot of ground here, Dennis Bernstein. Cocaine from the Contras, nuclear power, the future of radio, and your wonderful poetry. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back again next week with more from the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I am here in California for another week. We are fighting very hard, and Dennis has been helping us to shut down the two remaining nuclear reactors in California. They are at Diablo Canyon in San Luis Obispo. They're called Diablo Canyon, Devil's Canyon, and they are 1,200 megawatts, sitting around 13, 14, or 15 different earthquake faults. And we are doing our very best to shut them all down. We will be back with you next week for ways to do it. Dennis Bernstein, thanks again. The book is Special Ed. The show is... Flashpoint at KPFA. We'll see you next week. Thanks to the crew in New York.
Thank you. And so we went digging into the ground.